This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Time for us all to check our clocks on the departure of U.S. troops from Iraq. That development, said George Bush yesterday, will come under future presidents and future governments of Iraq. In other words, January 2009 at the earliest, nearly 3 years from now, when President Bush is no longer in charge. In a head-turning press conference yesterday, the president conceded he has poured his second-term political capital essentially into one pot, the war in Iraq, and that war is deeply trying the country's patience and confidence. There was no new plan and will be no new leadership, said the president, defending Donald Rumsfeld. But stick with me, he essentially asked, until I'm gone. Up next on Point, President Bush hands the war to the next president. Joining me now from Washington are two reporters. Bennett Roth is Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Bennett, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ryan Lizza is White House correspondent for the New Republic magazine. Ryan Lizza, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Bennett Roth, I think you watched this on Air Force Two with Vice President Dick Cheney. Am I right? How did the Vice President like it?
Well, the Vice President had his own speech ready that day, which he was sort of echoing President Bush's contentions and playing actually maybe even more of the bad cop, where he went to Scott Air Force Base and basically derided the defeatist attitude of Democrats who are trying to call for withdrawal. So he was there to amplify Bush's message.
The VP amplifying. Ryan Lizza, what did you see in the president's kind of long dance at the podium yesterday?
The obvious headline is the one you led with, which is that, and I don't think Bush intended to make that news. I think that was a sort of off the cuff remark, the remark about future presidents. And really, if you take him literally, we're not just talking one president; we're talking beyond 2009. He's talking about presidents
potentially, possibly, but at the very least, that would mean 2009. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. It does go to show you how long term he views the commitment to Iraq is, and that was definitely the headline. The other thing was, it was very feisty. He was very off the cuff. There was a lot of back and forth with reporters. Iraq obviously dominated the press conference in a way that it hasn't dominated previous press conferences. There was question after question about it. There was a lot of follow-up on the issue, too, which there isn't always with the White House press corps. I think the White House believes and has believed for a long time that Bush, but just by speaking, that Bush can change minds and that Bush can rally people to the war, and they've just sort of exhausted the ability of rhetoric to do a whole lot. It's almost parody at this point when they announce a new series of speeches to rally the American people around the war in Iraq. It's event driven at this point, and press conferences and Bush speeches aren't going to change the way that most people view this war. It's events on the ground that are going to do that.
Bennett Roth, Ryan Lizza, let's listen to a moment to that exchange in more length where the president talks about the withdrawal of U.S. troops being up to future presidents. Here's a fuller cut of that bit of the press conference.
Is there a point at which having the American forces in Iraq becomes more a part of the problem than a part of the solution? Can you say that you will not keep American troops in there if they're caught in a crossfire in a civil war? And can you say to the American people, assure them, that there will come a day when there will be no more American forces in Iraq?
Bob, the decisions about our troop levels will be made by General Casey and the commanders on the ground. They're the ones who can best judge whether or not the presence of coalition troops create more of a problem than a solution, than be a part of the solution. Secondly, I've answered the question on civil war. Our job is to make sure the civil war doesn't happen, but there will be. But if there is sectarian violence, that's the job of the Iraqi forces with coalition help to separate those sectarian forces. Third part of your question
was: will there come a day? And I'm not asking you when. I'm not asking for a timetable. Will there come a day when there will be no more American forces in Iraq?
That, of course, is an objective, and that'll be decided by future presidents and future governments of Iraq.
And there it is, American troop withdrawal from Iraq as an objective, and the timeline to be decided by future presidents. That means after Inauguration Day 2009. Ryan Lizza, is this something that the country should have understood all along? Has this always been implicit in the American involvement in Iraq?
or do you see this as coming as news?
It's definitely, look, I think if you were paying very, very close attention all the way through, you know, a lot of people were making the point that this is going to be a long, long, open-ended commitment. And we weren't always hearing that from the White House. So I think you had, there are obviously voices that have made this point and realized that this wasn't going to be a quick in-and-out war from day one. Now, George W. Bush and most of his the people around him have always been very wary of being honest about that point. And it's kind of it's actually sort of a strange way to break this news in a sort of off the cuff remark at a press conference, right? It wasn't his opening remark or anything. So I think this will come as a surprise to most people.
And Bennett Roth, the president has been very reluctant normally to put any kind of date on this. So I guess in a way that's what turns people's heads here. He's always said, when my commanders tell me we can leave, we'll leave. Of course, that raises questions on its own. But he's been so reluctant to put any date out there. Now, by hook or by crook, there is one.
Yes, he has. I mean, I think both for political reasons and for strategic reasons. He said he does not want to, you know, tip off the insurgency when we're leaving. But I think also here, he doesn't want to raise false expectations with Americans and then have to backtrack and that kind of thing. And I think the people probably most surprised and probably unhappy with this announcement by the president are the potential 2008 candidates for president, because this pretty much ensures that 2008 will be a major debate on Iraq and could be a referendum on Iraq, and, you know, that the country will essentially probably speak its mind at that time of which direction it wants to go.
In the interim, I suppose the president could... Ryan, I hear you there. Sorry.
No, I was going to say that's an excellent point, because to me, one of the things that came out of this press conference for me is that the president is starting thinking about who's going to succeed him, mm-hmm. and he's giving us a hint here about the kind of person he wants in the White House.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is when George W. Bush is not, his vice president isn't running, so he has no obvious successor. So it's a big mystery about who he might back in the 2008 Republican primaries. And I think what we're beginning to see is that he realizes his legacy is not tax cuts. It's not anything else he's done. It's the war in Iraq. And that's how he's going to be judged by history. So his fate in a lot of ways and his legacy is tied to his successor, because he's not going to be there to finish the war in Iraq and to assure it's a success. So I think when you start to think about who Bush might back, you have to look at it strictly through the prism of Iraq and terrorism. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's sort of interesting, looking at the 2008 Republican field and trying to figure out which one of those candidates is closest to his position on Iraq.
Because he won't be there. Yeah, Bennett.
It will also force the Democrats to come up with maybe a more coherent vision on Iraq, which they've so far, not been able to do and been afraid of doing. And this time, whether it be Hillary Rodham Clinton or any other candidate, they're going to have to come up with a plan for Iraq.
Of course, one thing the president could do in the meantime would be to put forward new plans or a new strategy himself. There's been a lot of pressure on that front, pressure including calls for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. Last week, General Paul Eaton, who was in charge of training Iraqi forces in Iraq for a long time, saying Rumsfeld should resign. The president was asked about that yesterday and stood by his man. Let's listen.
You said you listened to members of Congress, and there have been growing calls from some of those members for the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, also from his own former subordinates like U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton, who described him in a recent editorial as incompetent and tactically inept. Do you feel that personally you've ever gotten bad advice in the conduct of the war in Iraq, and do you believe Rumsfeld should resign?
No, I don't believe he should resign. I think he's done a fine job of not only conducting two battles, Afghanistan and Iraq, but also transforming our military, which has been a very difficult job inside the Pentagon.
He's done a fine job, said the president, though we have heard calls from any number of quarters now for new leadership, for new blood, for Rumsfeld, perhaps in particular, to go. Bennett Roth, how do you read that? Was there ever any doubt that this president would stick with Rumsfeld? There has been a lot of talk in Washington that he might buy himself some fresh support if he had a fresh team there.
But that goes against the grain of this president, who values loyalty above all else. And I think it would take an amazing act of disloyalty by Rumsfeld, or not sure exactly what it would take, but for someone for him to push Rumsfeld out. I mean, he he has this comfort zone. I mean, of advisors that he's unwilling to part with, and that some people see that as a major flaw, some people see that as a plus in his presidency.
Ryan Lizza, how do you interpret the president's famous resolve, even stubbornness? Is it still working for him or working against him here?
Well, look, I personally think it's working against him. I think that the problem is, he can't get rid of Rumsfeld because that would be an admission of defeat. It'd be admitting if he fired Rumsfeld, it would be admitting that Rumsfeld as a Secretary of Defense during this war has been a failure.
For a look at what the president said and did not say about the progress and strategy of the war, I want to invite into our conversation for a moment Anthony Cordesman. He's the chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, former national security assistant to Senator John McCain, author of The Iraq War. Anthony Cordesman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You have said that the president's remarks yesterday were still exercises in spin. What do you mean?
Almost speech by speech, he is being gradually pushed towards leveling with the American people. To say we're going to be in Iraq after 2008 is something that basically the U.S. military has been saying since really early 2005. But when you look at what he says, he still doesn't provide meaningful data on the development of Iraqi forces. All he does is tout the most successful units. He ignores the fact that the police, Ministry of Interior forces, are a major problem. That really the units he keeps talking about as being independent and in the lead are not. They can only function with U.S. forces and air power. He really does not get into any of the broad issues of making these forces independent, something for which we've never seen a plan or funding. He talks about the political side of this only in positive terms, but the elections have done as much to divide the country as unite it. And the fact is that when people vote for sectarian parties, it doesn't mean that somehow they are committed to unity. When it comes down to the economic side, almost everything remains a major misstatement. There's no discussion of unemployment. There's no discussion of the failures in the aid process. There's no real discussion of where Iraq will go now that aid money is largely exhausted. There is no real discussion of what's happening in critical areas like the oil sector. What there is the same group of essentially phony statistics that people have been issuing almost since 2003. We have a long way to go before the president simply says to the American people, here are the problems, here are the challenges, here is why we really have to stick with this, here are the measures to show that over time this plan can actually work, is distinguished from issuing spin and the equivalent of a campaign speech.
Anthony Cordesman, we see you as a pretty sober analyst here. You look at big strategy, and of course at this point the political and military have intersected. The president needs the nation's backing, ultimately, or the next president will, to continue this war. So what could he say? He has to win that backing. If he laid out all the problems that you're describing, might he not just scare Americans right off the playing board?
The polls show that when he attempts to not lay these problems out, Americans simply don't trust what he says. And things are made worse when you get the sort of sloganeering and much more polarized speeches you get out of people like Secretary Rumsfeld and especially Vice President Cheney. Leadership isn't trying to get through the next couple of weeks and hoping everything will suddenly get radically better. At some point, you have to explain what the challenges really are. You have to provide a truly convincing rationale for going on with this. You have to convince people you know what you're doing, you're being honest, and the effort is worthwhile. That's leadership.
Can that be done? And if it can, why wouldn't the president be doing it, in your view?
I think that almost on every issue, this presidency has been remarkably spin-driven, campaign-driven, has shown really almost no real ability to look down the line towards the future. This is not the kind of leadership you would have had out of President Roosevelt's fireside chats. It's not the kind of conceptual speech that Reagan could give and then follow up with action. It's almost a constant business of damage control, minimizing the problem, telling everybody everything's all right, and then suddenly discovering it doesn't work a couple of weeks or months later.
And yet Americans don't want to fail. We've got listeners who are supportive of the president. Anthony Cordesman, with your permission, I'd like to hear from one of them. Valerie's calling from Crownville, Maryland. Hi, Valerie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think, Valerie?
Well, the question is, did I listen to the speech?
Yes.
And do I still support President Bush?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I did listen to the speech, not once, but more than once, mm-hmm. unedited, without comment. I absorbed it. I trust the man. I believe him. And he is doing everything that your guest is saying that he's not, and he has been for several years.
You think he's laying it all out with perfect candor, or you feel well led?
I feel well led in terms of letting it out with perfect candor. He's trying desperately. But the way I've come out of this after several years now of listening to C-SPAN, actually radio,
yes.
without the comments,
mm-hmm.
is I feel that he's being unduly criticized at a dire time in our history, and we're going to go the wrong way if the people like your guest convince people that don't listen to the words coming out of the horse's mouth, so to speak, and then sit back and watch what is happening without the comments of people trying to persuade you otherwise. But things are working.
Things are working. Valerie,
it's a horrible situation. Don't get me wrong.
You think it's being twisted by what? By analysts, by interpreters,
yes.
by the media.
Absolutely. I have done for a while. It's very upsetting.
We hear that in your voice. Let us pick it up. Anthony Cordesman, Valerie listens. Of course, lots of people can listen. It's not a secret. You can hear. She wants to believe the president. She says he's telling it like it is. It's the critics who are spinning here.
I think the reality is you don't get major shifts in American public opinion because of commentators or what people say in the Congress. You get it because people watch the way the administration makes its case over a period of months and years. The fact is that this particular approach to making the case, and frankly, I think there is a far better case to be made simply by being honest than the president has made, has cost him support. He's preaching to the converted, and there are fewer converted every time. And every single public opinion poll shows how dangerous this particular approach to making his case is.
Would you turn over the leadership at the Pentagon? Is it time for that or no?
I think the problem always here is turn it over to whom? If it was Gordon Englund, I think probably it's time. It's time to have a less controversial official.
Remind us who Gordon Englund is, please.
He mm-hmm. is the deputy secretary.
And his background?
His background is essentially he's been Secretary of the Navy. He's coordinated much of the Quadrennial Defense Review. He's mm-hmm. done with the budget issues. He is not political. He's not polarized. He's somebody who works well with the military. And that, I'm afraid, in many areas, is what Secretary Rumsfeld is not.
Andrew Sullivan says bring in a tough-minded Democrat. What about Joe Lieberman, a unity sort of leadership there?
I think the problem is this isn't politics. This is the need for real management and leadership, bringing in somebody who is, again, taken a highly polarized stand with no experience at all in administering the Department of Defense or actually running a war at a time when success is absolutely critical is a marvelous exercise in political symbolism. But you're running a business institution in a war. You've got 130,000 people deployed and you're spending something like $500 billion. Political symbolism simply doesn't hack it when you have a real-world job to do.
Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of The Iraq War. Tony Cordesman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ryan Lizza, Bennett Roth, listen with me for just a moment to Helen Thomas, now a longtime White House reporter, now columnist, mixing it up with President Bush.
Your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis. Wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? mm-hmm. from the moment you stepped into the White House, yeah. from your cabinet former cabinet officers, intelligence people, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
Yeah, I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, is that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy, but we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq.
President Bush responding yesterday in the White House press conference to Helen Thomas. Bennett Roth, it's been a long time since he's called on Helen Thomas, a long time that she's been in the White House. What did you make of that exchange?
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, Helen has been on the so-called do not call list of the president. I mean, she's been a ferocious critic of their policies in the daily briefings with Scott McClellan. And I think that they decided they didn't want to give her more voice. But I think this was part of the president's new strategy to take on his critics. I mean, he's been doing it more and more, fielding questions at forums from people who are not necessarily friendly with him. It's sort of, give me your best shot. And I think that's what he was doing in his essence yesterday, is I'm going to take the tough questions and I can field them. And I think the president showed that he can actually. He doesn't have to be insulated from people who are not necessarily friendly to him in dealing with these issues.
Ryan, Lindsay, if he can pick that up from Helen Thomas, what does he have to fear exactly, except the poll numbers, which would stink?
That's right. I mean, look, there's a lot of criticism of Helen Thomas among both White House reporters and people in the White House, but, you know, I think moments like those are what's great about our system. I think there should be more people in there, like Helen, just sort of, you know, smacking him with these open-ended, very, very tough questions. And you know, his answer is very instructive. First of all, I don't think it's quite honest to say that everything that Iraq was suddenly a ripe issue because of what happened on 9/11.
Out of nowhere. Mm-hmm.
Out of nowhere. Of course, most of the people in his administration supported the overthrow of Saddam, at least the foreign policy and national security folks, before 9/11.
Bush Sr. Hadn't done it. They wanted it done.
Exactly. I mean, and that's common knowledge. The second part of his answer gets to the sort of the whole debate about what we should have been doing after 9/11, and whether going into Iraq had anything to do with what we learned on 9/11. Okay, we know that Al Qaeda was not in Iraq. We know that there were no substantial links between Saddam and Al Qaeda. So the idea that Al-Qaeda, that we needed to take out Saddam, this after-the-fact reasoning, because it could have been a safe haven for Al-Qaeda, strikes me as dishonest, and one of the problems that Anthony Quartersman was talking about with this president. Mm.
But I do think, if I can say,
yeah. Al-Qaeda is a problem in Iraq now. It wasn't before. Mm.
Mm. I do think the administration has found this is an appealing rationale, that tying Iraq to 9/11 has worked for them in 2004 and that the more they can bring up the specter of the World Trade Center and people killed, the more frightened Americans become.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it has worked on an emotional level, maybe not a rational, but an emotional level.
I want to bring a conservative voice in here, if I may. Stephen Hayes joins us from Washington, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, author of The Connection. Stephen Hayes, thanks for being with us. What did you make of the president's case yesterday? Is it still working?
Well, it won't surprise you that I disagree with Ryan. I think that the president's answer to Helen Thomas was, I thought, pretty forceful. It was a smart answer, and I don't think it was particularly misleading. I think the thing to remember about the case the administration made with respect to Iraq and when it talked about Iraq in the context of 9/11 was really more of a threshold question. What was the acceptable level of threshold for threats after 9/11? And I think it's entirely appropriate for the president to talk about going after Saddam Hussein, who had a long record of supporting terrorists, did have links to al-Qaeda. We can debate whether they were substantial, I think was the word Ryan used, or not, but certainly had connections to al-Qaeda, had connections to a wide variety of terrorists.
But is trust me and stay the course good enough at this point in the war, Stephen Hayes?
Well, I don't think so. I think, you know, one of the things I think the president and his administration should be doing is making more use of these documents that are now being posted by the Director of National Intelligence.
Which documents?
We collected the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus collected 2 million plus documents in Afghanistan and Iraq following the wars in those countries. Those documents have largely gone unexploited to this point.
What are you suggesting? It sounds like I have documents in my briefcase that will prove beyond. What do they say?
Well, I think some of the documents are pretty interesting. There was one that was posted yesterday that had been previously reported by the New York Times, and the Times reported that it had been authenticated by a Pentagon task force that was a 1997 document that talked about Saddam's cultivation of four different Saudi opposition groups, including what the Iraqi intelligence service in this internal memo referred to as the Reform and Advice Committee headed by bin Laden.
Why hasn't the president been able to get the country behind him on this war? The numbers are going the wrong way for him. Why?
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons I think we saw him correct this a little bit is that he's for a long time, too long, I think he refused to defend the rationales for the war. I think you saw this in 2003, then throughout the 2004 presidential campaign, he was forced to because his opponents were making him answer questions about why he took the country to war. And I think he made a forceful and often persuasive case that going to war in Iraq was not only the right thing to do, but something that made us safer. They essentially abandoned that case after the president was reelected and didn't make it forcefully again for almost a full year. I think he's returning.
Is it a rhetorical issue then? It's a rhetorical reason that the country doesn't support the war?
Well,
Stephen?
I think that's part of it. Certainly, you know, the conditions on the ground, the fact that we see on the nightly news every night IEDs exploding, certainly the security situation is worse than the administration, or frankly, most people thought it would be 3 years on. There's no question about that. But I think, you know, the president continuing to make his case on his own behalf will certainly help him.
Stephen Hayes at the Weekly Standard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ryan, Lizza, I hear you there. What do you think? Why is the country, is it obvious that the, you know, that it's going that badly, so what's to argue about?
I think it's a lot simpler than Steve makes it sound. Mm-hmm. I think it has very little to do with rhetoric. Bush has the biggest megaphone in the world. He's been making his case on the war since day one. There are two problems. One is the case that he made for war before the war started has completely fallen apart, and anyone with half a brain realizes that. And a lot of the American people no longer, according to the polls, trust what the president says about the war. That's his biggest problem with trying to persuade them. Number two is the facts on the ground don't match with Bush's rhetoric, as Anthony Cordesman laid out in great detail. And people don't see progress in the war, and that's why they've turned against it. I think it has very little to do with Bush's critics attacking him and not forcefully responding. He talks about the war all the time. And he makes the case every day.
Tony's calling from Frederick City, Maryland. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you taking my call this morning.
Good to have you. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I'll tell you this. Your last commentator just made the statement that President Bush lied and entered into war on false premises.
No, I didn't say he lied. I said the case he made for the war has fallen apart.
Okay, well, first of all, it's too early to say that it's fallen apart because, you know, you don't know where the weapons that Saddam Hussein was developing have gone to. You've not searched out every ally to that country close by. Very easily that stuff could have been moved. You can't make a case to
say that.
Well,
it's pretty much MIA, though, that stuff. So what do you think beyond that, Tony?
Well, I think that he went in Regardless of the weapons of mass destruction, I think that he went in because Saddam Hussein was thumbing his nose at the UN. I think that somebody needed to stand up with some backbone and make him accountable for the laws that he was breaking.
Is it worth it? Is stopping a dictator from thumbing his nose worth the American lives, the Iraqi lives, the billions and billions, Tony?
Well, let me ask you this, sir. Right now, Iran is in the same position. The leader of Iran is thumbing his nose at the UN, making very bold statements about the United States and the EU. I think that right now Iran really needs to be dealt with. But the fact that the American people and critics of the president spreading their poison into their ears, I think they can't stomach what needs to be done to win the war in Iraq right now, let alone deal with Iran like Iran really should be dealt with.
And what are you suggesting, that if we just got on board with the president, we could take the American military on into Iran as well, and that's the way to go?
Well, I think that we need to stop swatting at flies and go get the nest. And I think that everyone that has any sense, you made the statement before, anybody is not blind or anybody that has a brain. I think anybody that has a brain realizes that we really have not been allowed to deal with this like we need to deal. We need to go in and get the whole nest. We need to be very aggressive. We need to just simply stop talking and act. But we're restrained by public opinion. I think public opinion has definitely hurt our effort to win in this insurgency. I think the insurgency has been strengthened. I think that they're financed heavily by Iran, and we're just simply not going to be able to deal with it if we keep dealing with it like a bunch of sissies.
We hear it, but it is a democracy, and I don't suppose it's full of sissies, but we thank you for your call. Bennett Roth, there's the hardcore. There's the nut of support, ready to go with the president, put on the pack, go right on to Tehran.
But I'm not sure he's in the majority there, and I think the problem with Iraq is that the public has become war weary, and I think it's going to be tougher to deal with Iran, North Korea, or other hotspots because our troops are stretched thin right now. And again, the public, just after more than three years of war, when we were mostly through World War II at this period, I believe,
yes, you were.
That the public, I don't think, has the stomach for launching another military campaign right now. And I think the president knows that, which is why he is not threatening military action at the moment. But that may be one of the casualties of the Iraq war, is that it's going to be difficult. Just like after Vietnam, it took years for the United States to again feel that it could launch a military campaign. And that may be one of the negative impacts of all of this.
I have to say, to Tony's point, I mean, the president did have an awfully free hand to go in more or less anywhere he liked, as heavily as he and Donald Rumsfeld wanted for a long time here. I want to welcome one more voice into our conversation. David Gergen, professor of public service at Harvard's JFK School of Government, served as an advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. David Gergen, thanks for being with us. What did you see in the president's performance yesterday?
Well, delighted to join the conversation. I saw more hold the course, and that it's a course that is not winning public support now. And as much as I welcome him taking questions from the press and now unscripted questions from the audience, which I think is a good thing. You know, only a few weeks ago, we were hitting him pretty hard for being isolated, for being in a bubble. He's gotten out of the bubble, so let's celebrate that. But having said that, to go to where you just were in your conversation, you know, the president could easily have sent in 250,000-300,000 troops at the beginning of this. Indeed, the Secretary of the Army, Eric Shinseki, argued for exactly that, to go in heavy, to follow the Powell Doctrine, in effect, and he was squelched. And not only was he squelched, they fired him. But had the public would have supported that, and we would now be in a place where we would have much less of an insurgency than we have. It's very hard, you know, 3 years in, to suddenly come back and say, we got to send a lot more troops. And McCain's been arguing this. I believe it. There was a time we should have sent a lot more troops here in the last couple of years. But now it's hard. The Army is stretched very thin. The Army does not want to go in heavy at this point, the U.S. Army.
In other words, they want out, or they want to stay the course.
Well, Colin Powell, who is, I think, an authority on these matters, has been arguing publicly since he left the State Department that the U.S. Army is like a rubber band, and you can stretch it, and you can stretch it, and they can do marvelous things, but at some point you stretch a rubber band too far, and it pops. And he argued that the pop point was probably coming sometime this fall. So, you know, we're approaching the time when we're going to have soldiers going back there, third and maybe even fourth tours, and that puts an enormous strain on the Army. One of the reasons the Army now wants to There are many people in the upper ranks of the Army who are not saying very much publicly, but are saying privately, you know, we really ought to look to reducing the commitment on the ground there. We don't want to break the back of the Army in Iraq. We do have Iran, after all, over the horizon. We have North Korea. We've got bigger fish to fry, frankly.
And meanwhile, the president's kind of handing the thing off to the next president, future presidents, he says. What do you think of that politically, militarily, David?
Well, I was quite surprised by that, by a statement yesterday. The future presidents will have to determine the withdrawal, because it certainly suggested that he intended to keep a very heavy presence there through the end of his presidency, which is contrary to everything that the administration and the Pentagon have been whispering for months now, that we would begin to draw down this year. One of the things I think is missing from this dialogue is there was a column by Jim Hoagland, it was very good, in the Washington Post this week, that his sources in the Pentagon were saying, and he thought there were hints of this in the public, were saying that what we would start doing this year is to begin withdrawing our troops from the streets and cities of Iraq and move them into bases outside the city, so, and let the Iraqi security forces take over responsibility in the streets and cities. And that would reduce the casualties significantly. There would still be a U.S. presence, but it would be, in effect, what he called an internal withdrawal. And that offered some, it seemed to me, that offered some sensibility as a strategy.
So in that case, maybe the president's talking about a long-term presence a la Germany or Japan post-World War II.
Yeah, that's right. Now, here's the catch. There will be an awful lot of people around the world who say, aha, we told you they're going to stay there. Now, why are they staying there? They're not really staying there because they want to keep the violence down. There are going to be a lot of people getting killed, and they're staying there because of the oil. And that's the danger of leaving people on the ground in remote outposts over a long period of time. I think ultimately we're going to have to get out of there to convince the world that this wasn't about oil. But I can see that as being an interim, you know, a medium-term strategy, as internal withdrawal is a medium-term strategy on the road toward moving out altogether.
And then another president works it out. David Gergen, former advisor to Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Vicki's calling from Woodstock, Virginia. Hi, Vicki. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What I'd like to share with the listeners is that, as a retired Army officer, I think Rumsfeld has been the problem.
How? Why?
I think General Eaton's comment is very telling. The general said that Rumsfeld was committing tactical errors. What is a Secretary of Defense doing at the tactical level of warfare? We have made awful strategic blunders, and those only can be attributed to Rumsfeld. He's been way too involved in the war fighting.
But the president always says he's leaving it up to the generals. This is a constant refrain.
But you can see that in Eaton's comment that it's not true. The generals can't come up to the media and say it isn't. They're trying their very best. But I'll tell you, I worked in the operations center, and there are decisions that are being made that the generals really can't control. They make recommendations, and the senior leadership makes decisions, and that's the way it goes. And they're going to execute. So we've made strategic problems, which I think show that not only was Shinseki right, but that the military leadership is not being enabled to do their job.
There's a voice from retired military saying, give it to the generals. In fact, not just in rhetoric. Vicki, thanks for your call. Bennett Roth, what about withdrawal? There's been a lot of talk about where troop numbers may go this year. On the other hand, we see fresh attacks and bigger attacks very recently than we've seen before. What's the latest in your understanding of what the generals would in fact like to do, or Donald Rumsfeld would like to do, with troop levels soon?
Well, there have been hints, and I think General Casey hinted earlier in this last weekend that there would be some gradual withdrawal this year. And it had always been assumed, actually, before the 2006 midterm congressional elections, that we'd draw down enough to give certainly Republicans cover when they ran for reelection. But that's why I think some people were surprised at President Bush's statement yesterday, because it seemed to contradict the trend that the generals had said. And so it's just not clear where we're going.
I guess not. Let's get Jack in Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello. What do you think, Jack?
If I can, I'd like to make 2 points.
Mm-hmm.
My first point is that the Bush administration never intended to quickly go into Iraq and leave. They always planned to have domineering military presence. I won't call it occupation.
You really think they wanted all this expenditure, these billions, the death count and the whole thing?
Well, they weren't really counting on that. They thought they would have flowers thrown at them because they have plans to make permanent military bases in Iraq, and there is also plans, almost $1 billion have been appropriated for the largest U.S. embassy in the world.
So there's your evidence of a long-term footprint. Our time is short, but thanks for your call. Yeah. Jack, Ryan, you've looked at and thought about how future GOP candidates may have to deal with this potato, and for that matter, Democratic candidates for the White House. The president's explicitly handing it off in some degree now. What does this look like to the men or women who might follow him?
It's a good question. I'm looking at the Republicans that are trying to, they're jockeying to succeed him. I get the sense that they're all of a sudden sort of reconsidering where they're going to come down on the war. And my guess would be that Bush is looking to the person who is going to absolutely, be absolutely committed to seeing this thing through.
Is it going to be Bush's to choose, given his opinion poll ratings?
Even Republicans are starting to abandon him to a certain degree. But having said that, his operation, his donors, and a very, very large segment of the conservative base that decides Republican primaries is still loyal to him. And if he were to wink and nod in the direction of one of the Republican candidates, it would mean something.
So in your political calculus, despite the polls against the war, when the president says it's going to be up to future presidents, does he have a comfort level that, in fact, that's the case? That's the bottom line political calculus here. This is going to go on because there's not the political leverage to stop it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, look, we've built this program around that one comment in the press conference. Now, let's take one step back it'd be interesting to see what the White House says this week now that this has sort of been the headline out of the news conference. You know, did Bush really mean a massive commitment, or was he just sort of stating the obvious that there'll be some level of troops in country through 2009, and perhaps he wasn't suggesting the same sort of level now. I mean, that's what we'll have to see in the next few days, how far they push back on from that statement.
So look for the shadings to come. Ryan Lizza,
exactly.
At the New Republic, thanks very much, Ryan, for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Bennett Roth, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Bennett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.